Now, in the territory, I think it was last week, there was a coroner's report came down about a death in custody out there, and found that the police failed in their duties. Can you just tell us a little about that?
Well, the 28-year-old man who died in that cell, they've now attributed to negligence and all the way through the various layers of the police that they hadn't, you know, paid an appropriate duty of care. They've come out with more recommendations about nurses on call and, you know, medical attention prior to being locked up, when, especially because this man had come in inebriated. But what wasn't nailed on the head there was that this man, like Mr. Ward, who died in the back of a prison van, should never have been arrested in the first place. He should have been escorted home to his community, to his home for his family. You know, you don't put everybody in for the sake of expediency into a cell lockup. Now, the whole story of what may have happened, just like Palm Island, has not got out in the first instance. What they're trying to attribute now is, you know, that he died of pulmonary failure, and as 28 years of age, and that if he'd been given medical attention, or he'd been seen by a nurse, he could probably he would be alive still today. So they want more checks and balances, and the police there are now saying that they will do that. But see, none of this stuff is new. None of this stuff that they're actually saying is anything new. It's all come out, you know, from the Royal Commission into Aboriginal Deaths in Custody, and the many subsequent reports since. There was never, even though 338 of those recommendations were supported by the Australian Senate from the Royal Commission into Deaths in Custody, there's no legislation that says they have to be implemented. So many of them have not been implemented. Others which have been implemented, the full weight of them haven't been implemented. An Indigenous Law Bulletin review a couple of years ago said something like 50% of all the recommendations in some jurisdictions have been implemented, and of those, 22% to the full weight. So the reality is they haven't been implemented. A quarter of a half, you know, have been weighted into the systems, various systems, and not all systems. But there's nothing new that's actually come out of this report that gives me any light or any heart or warmth that anything much is going to change. There's just been a mention by the police the Northern Territory that they're going to take things a little bit more seriously and make sure they've got more checks and balances in there, and flag medical attention when it should be flagged. But that stuff should be happening. We don't need another coroner's report, and I've listened to upteen coroner's reports over the last several years, and little has changed. But I do respect that they have come back, you know, slamming the police handling and also the police investigation into the handling of this man's death. However, it's still classified as a natural cause of death. And I think, you know, that is a worry in itself, because the rise in natural cause death is as a manner of classification, which comes out of the coroner's, you know, judgments, has risen in this country. So we've got, as you said at the beginning of the show, one of the world's worst prison and police custodial death rates, and they're either stagnant or increasing. They haven't significantly reduced in any jurisdiction, and things are as bad as they are and have been for 20 years, and need to be improved in many other ways. But the key element of this that didn't come out was that this man should not have been in the lockup. There should have been de-escalation, mediation, and off homeward bound, or whatever. You know, they should have just dropped him off home and let him sleep off, you know, or they should have taken him straight to a hospital.
Why was he in? Was he intoxicated, or what was he put in? What's their excuse?
Well, the assumption of intoxication is always an allegation, whatever. Right? So, you know, he was in for disorderly, and you know, he was in for disorderly, and there's an you know, an allegation that he was violently disorderly. But you know, number of people being picked up for disorderlies. There's the argument that, you know, considering that the only determinant may have been that they're just wandering the street on their way homeward bound, because he was homeward bound, and that's a key element that shouldn't be overridden. You know, there's a rise in just a quick arrest and lock-up. And the argument from the police sometimes is they're under-resourced and got to hit the streets again or whatever, right, to make sure that they're keeping the streets safe. But my argument is that, you know, Alice Springs is a massive, and they could have just dropped him off or whatever. Right?
What about the options, the alternatives that were set up back in the 80s after the deaths in custody, Royal Commission, the watch committees, what are they called? There's one in Western Australia.
Deaths in
custody watch committees. Like, isn't there alternatives? What I'm trying to get to is, aren't there alternatives where police can take people, like they used to be proclaimed places that Aboriginal people ran in New South Wales back in the 80s, that was an alternative. They could take them along. The police could pick someone up that's drunk or not behaving well for the police liking, and just take them over to a First Nations place where they can sober up, have a sleep, a safe house. Are they not in place?
Most of them are not in place. A lot of things have actually deteriorated or have been neglected. Look, that's actually a very good suggestion, and that's actually what should happen. I'm pretty sure in Alice Springs, just like there is in West Australia and the southwest, there's Noongar Patrol here, whatever. Right? So, you know, all they needed, if this had occurred in anywhere in the southwest or in Perth, they'd call the Noongar Patrol. They could take care of them and take them somewhere safe or whatever. Right? And Noongar Patrol does do the streets of Perth and other regions. But similarly, there must be something obviously in Alice Springs, and yes, I agree with that. They could have called up just a First Nations safe house, family, community group, or whatever, and they should be organising these things. This actually strikes a chord with me, what you've said, Tiger, because I was recently up in Geraldton, and you've interviewed recently Joyce Capel, the lady who's actually arguing the house down against the Department of Corrective Services in Grenith Prison, where there was a double suicide.
She's a prison officer, isn't she? A First Nations prison officer there, yeah.
Yeah, she's a First Nations prison officer under the Aboriginal Visitor Scheme. Now, that was actually as a result of the... It was part of the core recommendations of the Royal Commission, the Death in Custody, but it was also preempted, you know, and would later be part of the 339 recommendations. It came in 1988 as the inquiry was, you know, underway. That what you've just suggested and is actually also the Aboriginal Visitor Scheme, you know, and these are also people that could be called into themselves, the Aboriginal Visitor Scheme itself, to actually, you know, take care of somebody in that predicament. But, you know, she's fighting the house down because the Aboriginal Visitor Scheme right throughout Geraldton, the entire Yamatji region, Mikathara, Carnarvon, all of it, has been down for 3 years. Now, that was actually a core recommendation prior to the 339 recommendations. It goes back to 1988 that there are supposed to be, you know, First Nation peoples working with their people in these times of need for counselling, assistance and so forth or whatever, and safe space. But, you know, that scheme has been down now for 2 and 3 and 4 years in most of the region I've just described, which is a vast region reaching into the goldfields of Western Australia. And and even with the police watch houses in those regions, not just the prisons, I've talked to the acting district superintendent when I went up to Grenith.
What's their response? I'm sure they would welcome these sort of options. I mean, a lot of them don't want to be tied down with paperwork or the hassles and even sometimes the abuse and stuff. I'm sure a lot of them would like to see a community place, a safe house where people, where they could be, yeah, where there's some trust and some dialogue and communication. What's the police response to the ones you're talking to?
Well, their response is we welcome it. But, you know, they've demonstrated they don't have the will to do it themselves and actually work with groups and get this up and running. They just said, well, if the Aboriginal community comes back to us and get some responsible people and some responsible groups, you know, we'll consider it all. Just bring us names and we'll put it all together.
Maybe the responsibility is up to us, no matter whether we be Brisbane or Perth or Kalgoorlie or where. Maybe the responsibility is up to us initially. If we're concerned about our people being locked up and then being a statistic, a death in custody, and we are, there's no question about that. I think we need to go the next step and look around and just start some voluntary thing up. But anyway, over to you.
I agree with you there. I agree with you there because that actually is restorative justice. And in the end, if there isn't a will on the part of others, but they've put out a welcome mat, then, you know, I think the message has to get out that, you know, if we could do something to help our own, then let's do it. And the various Aboriginal corporations and community groups can get up and put these safe spaces, just like the patrols, like the Noongar Patrol.
Same way, yes.
Safely home. Yeah, so same way. And maybe, you know, the Aboriginal Legal Services can dip their coordinating hands into it, or just their inspiration. And actually, that has been put out there. When I was at Geraldton, I'll be going back up there again to talk to a Yamaji meeting that's been convened, or listen to. That's a suggestion I might put to some of the people behind the scenes or whatever, that maybe this is the way they need to go. But they've also imputed that this is possibly the way to go, that we may have to take matters into our own hands and get these types of patrols and groups together.
There's that question. We have to do it, Jerry. We must do it. And I've got to get off my butt and do something about it here in Brisbane, but we must do it. I mean, we need to be proactive rather than reactive. We need to organise. And I think, I mean, when you think about it, you've mentioned legal service, they may play a role. There are other services in the community that may be able to assist somehow without dipping into their budget, because none of us have a budget with any surplus in it where we can put into something like this. But a lot of us do have some time. A lot of us do have a company motor vehicle that's provided by the company that we work for. I think the resources and the will is there. It's just a matter of mobilising and organising, for starters.
Absolutely. I agree, and there's a lot of different groups that can get involved, but there is a will within community. I think it may actually just happen, and maybe our discussion on radio might actually get a few others to do it too, but I'll put the word out also, and I'm pretty sure something of this is going to eventuate now, because if it doesn't, you know, I think you're right. There has to be some proactivity. You are right, actually. And otherwise, you know, people will keep on getting arrested, the criminal experience in terms of being behind bars, and no one wants to be a statistic, and no one wants anyone to be a statistic. So I think everybody has to do something about stuff now.
Yep. Well, we planned the seed, and like I say, I've got to get off my butt and try and talk to some people and get something happening here in Brisbane. It's too easy for a big mouth like me to sit at a microphone and say these things. It's time that I took some steps outside of this office doors. Now, listen, there was some months back where you and I were talking, and I got a phone call from a man, one of our listeners, called in from Brisbane here, and he told us about his brother, who he was extremely concerned about. And this fella happened to be a mainstream Australian, a white fella. Yep. And he told us about his brother, who was, I think, a Western Australian jail, and he was very concerned because he didn't have real good health. He was suffering some health issues. I have later learnt, thanks to your emails and connections, that that brother of this man that called me has since passed.
Yep. This is they're all tragic stories. This is a sad story. It actually brought me to tears when, you know, he called me on the day of his brother's death. The man's an avid listener. And he's listening to the program this morning, so he might even get a call in from, you know, Darren Axtell. And his partner is a Murray woman from Stradbroke Island. And, you know, yeah, he, as a result of your program, you and me being on the show, he contacted me to see if I can assist with his brother, who was caught up, you know, on remand in Western Australia. And for a minor issue where he probably shouldn't have been in there at all, it was a domestic issue, but there were mitigating circumstances that were clear as the light of day, and the man shouldn't have been in there. But he had a heart condition, and, you know, they were waiting to get him onto the organ donor list. He was in a very vulnerable, frail state. And yet, he should have been in full medical care, intensive care, from my understanding. And yet he was shuffled back and forth. Now, this is something that's happened to Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal people who are in dire health. And yet, instead of being left to get better in, even with guards outside the door, as it is always, left to get better in intensive care or in hospital care, they're shuffled back at the first chance to the prison system and they get worse. And I could go on with the litany of these stories, but I won't. I might wrap up with a few right at the end. But to keep on to this man, Anthony Axtell, who was only 38 years old, he had a heart condition. He had a frail heart. He needed a new heart. He wasn't going to make it. They all knew he was on death's door. anyway, he might still be alive if he got the appropriate medical care, and he might be on the organ donor list now or a little bit later down the track or whatever, but he needed to be kept in good care for that opportunity. They brought this man to hospital, shackled. Well, what was he going to do? They chained him. It's like the Aboriginal pregnant woman in South Australia who was giving birth and they had her ankles shackled. What was she going to do while she's giving birth? Get up and run or whatever, right, you know? The loss of dignity and the loss of, you know, restorative care and empathy to one another is just unbelievable, and the prison system fails people. But this man was shackled for a predominant period, I think till August 12, 30, 40 days at the hospital that he was in. His brother and his sister-in-law, who I mentioned, Murray lady from Stradbroke Island, and his father and mother, Brian and Elaine, were by his bedside for 45 days. And for a lot of that, he was shackled. And apparently his children, this man had three children, but his children would come in, and Darren's two-year-old son, Xavier, would come in and see his uncle or the children, their dad, and the man's shackled or whatever. You know, if you see images of him, he's frail, he's thin, his kidneys have failed, his organ, he's got perfusion organ failure. You know, he's no threat to nobody, but yet they've shackled him to the bed like some infirmary out of the 1700s or 1800s or whatever. You know, these images that we think are long gone and past. Anyway, a fortnight ago, he died at 11 a.m. on the Thursday. His brother called me a little bit later from that to tell me what had happened. And we had tried very hard to get this into the mainstream news media. No one wanted to hear a bar of it. In the end, we got snippets in a couple of paragraphs here and there. But I thought, you know, this is indicative of what's wrong with the system, the inhumanity, and also Western Australia, the DCS, the government, not, helping with the repatriation of this man whose funeral I think is today or tomorrow, Darren, or probably, say when, in Brisbane. The family still got to grieve. And it's today, actually, in Western Australia, in State Parliament, we've organised for the Labor Shadow Minister for the Department of Corrective Services to ask a series of questions. So they're on notice today. So probably at 2 p.m. this afternoon, Western Australian time, they'll be putting questions, which I've already seen, to the government. And the government minister, Murray Cowper, State Minister for the Department of Corrective Services, will be putting him to his department. But I just think we have to scrub up. We just have to treat people different, I think, better, with empathy. We have to consider their circumstance. If a man's a heart patient, treat him with the due and diligent care. If a lady's giving birth to a child, don't shackle the woman, you know, because that's just the due process or whatever that they've got as policy. Due process is compassion, humanity, decency, and empathy, and we've got to treat each other, one another. All prisons and the prison system will continue to be failed, will continue to have these high rates of maltreatment, and will continue to enshrine, despair in people. And as I've said many times before, you know, people, in my research, I have found come out of prisons worse than what they went in. The deaths rate 1 year after living in prison is 5 times worse than in the annual death rate in prison. 350 people released from prison each year die in that first year, either from self-injury, self-harm, suicide, drug addiction, so forth, or whatever. And that's because we've destroyed them. We've made them worse. They've gone in a bad state. They've come out worse.
Jerry, if they come out at all, yes. Jerry, isn't... I don't know, what's happened to such things as the legislation like workplace health and safety, duty of care? There are legislative requirements here, and why does it continue? It's almost like the police force, where there's a particular culture in the police forces across the country where it seems that maybe it's a minority of people that are corrupt or thumb their nose at the law that binds them. But what is it? I mean, hospital duty of care and stuff, workplace health and safety. Is there not no such legislation? Are they is it suspended? Don't they need to? You know, are they a privileged few that they don't need to worry about this sort of stuff? What's going on?
All of that. What you said causes a faith with dispensation, you know, lack of transparency. Look, my dad, he never had much of an education. He had 1 year of schooling in his whole life. He went, other than his first year of schooling, he never went to school again. He was a poor man, but he worked hard and became self-educated, but was a working class man. He taught his six children one thing or two things. And he goes, Jerry, all I'll ever teach you in life is always do what is right. And when someone asks you questions about your words or deeds, account for yourself. Always be in a position to account for yourself. This is what a lot of government bureaucracies don't do. They use the bullshit today of liability, that we could incriminate ourselves, that we'll finish up in court, that we could be sued. You know, they don't account for themselves. You know, this double suicide attempt that I talk about with Joyce Capel and ABS down in Geraldton, no one would have known about that because the DCS websites wouldn't have put it up or whatever, right? It was a whistleblower. She came to me, I broke the story out there, and we worked hard to get it out through the various media or whatever, right? Now, there's got to be a greater sense of transparency and accountability and a much more public sense of that. The big issue for me, and it's my mantra, and, you know, I know I never get off this mantra, is, you know, this business of police, investigating police, internal affairs and internal inquiries and major, you know, investigation squads and investigating other police, it's just not on. It should not be on. It's got to be demarcated police inspectorates investigating police that have nothing to do with police, whatever, right? Or even in the sense of a transfer of personnel, they've got to be totally demarcated. Similarly with the prison systems, similarly with government bureaucracies and all of it, that we've got to have external inquiry and we've got to have a greater sense of transparency. And when something goes wrong in the system, you know, it's got to go public, whatever, because that is the greatest scrutiny we can have of all. But when something does go wrong, unless it's actually a death in custody that gets a quick snippet on a website, because it has to, and because it's a death, it gets found out. Everything else, maltreatments, you know, all the shackling business, negligence by police officers or by some police officers, not all, because my brother-in-law's a police officer, not all police officers are bad, but, you know, negligence isn't necessarily intentional. It's often inadvertent, but if we have to sort it out, it's got to go public so we know about it. There's a lot of stuff that happens that, you know, when I tell people because of my research and you from the million of interviews that you've actually done and heard things and know from your own experiences, you know, half the people don't believe us. Whatever,
that's the sad part about it. A lot of people just don't believe us. Jerry, tell us about, there's been some real issues with release of prisoners for funerals. Now, this started some years ago, and there was a time I can recall, and it could be going back 20 to 30 years, maybe 15 years, where there was reasonable support for prisoners being released and escorted to funerals of close family. That changed a lot with the economic situation, economic rationality and stuff like this, where the authorities say, nah, families have got to pay. And it can be tens of thousands of dollars. Tell us about what you know with this release for funerals for our mob that are incarcerated. What do you know about it?
Well, the Department of Corrective Services in Western Australia says to me that there's never been a steadfast rule, whether you're Aboriginal or non-Aboriginal, to actually have permission to attend any funeral or to visit any very ill family member. However, it's been a general rule to get all Aboriginal inmates to their family funerals, particularly the parents. But the cost cutting has reached a new height in Western Australia, as it probably has, as you described, because of the austerity measures across the country. In Western Australia, the government's been seeking a 2% cut from all its departments, an efficacy cut, or whatever, to cut budgets. Now, the prisoner transport contract's actually run by Circa, the private multinational who runs just about everything now in the country. Anyway, and the contract in Western Australia is worth $1.1 million for our funeral transports, as I understand. But if it's a contract, it's already done and dusted, so I don't fully understand why they're asking of a contractee to try and make a saving or whatever. But if they cut that contract, for instance, the funeral transport, that would be the 2% that they're actually looking for. So they're looking for a $1 million saving in their budget, the Department of Corrective Services. Now, what happened as a result of that is all of a sudden children who are in prison, sons and daughters have not been able to attend their mother or father's funeral. And that's really outrageous. A son was not to attend his mother's funeral last Friday, and that just brought out an outcry. And they said that what they could do is actually Skype it to prison, televise it, put them in a private meeting room, and that it works, you know, well enough, and they've trialled it for others in the past. Well, many people, Noongars, actually rose to the occasion and said that that's culturally inappropriate, that's a disgrace, we need to grieve with family, it's culturally significant, and the son should be at his mother's funeral. Family, supported by the Noongar 10th Embassy and by some of the Deaths in Custody Watch Committee and others, you know, gathered outside Department of Corrective Services last Tuesday and protested the house down, flags all over the place, and they weren't going to be moved. DCS officials and the Assistant Commissioner, I believe, actually called some of the family in, which is the deceased's sister, the boy's aunt, and did a backflip on this particular occasion for the son to attend his mother's funeral, which he did on Friday. So, yeah, that backflip occurred, but that isn't a steadfast rule that it will be for others now. But the government's arguing that, you know, there's a big cost involved in transports. There are 35,000 transports of various nature, prisoner transports across the state, and that they've only budgeted $1.1 million for funeral transports. You know, but others are saying, and there'll be questions to government through the Labor Shadow Minister and also the Greens Shadow Minister for DC, for Department of Corrective Services, on the denial of customary rights and what needs to be done from here onwards to ensure that, you know, at least the children of you know, those deceased or parents are able to attend these funerals, because, you know, to any person, you know, like I put it to DCS, if it's one of your staff, you give them leave to get there. Now, you know, for Noongar folk or for any folk across the state, Yamaji or Gurbaloo or Jabajibu, to be hearing that that there's a cost involved, and, you know, and they're going to be denied right of attendance to their mother's funeral has upset a lot of people. But the questions will be asked, but, you know, but that protest, you know, much to the credit of people like the Noongar 10th Embassy, supported Vera Worrell, and to get her nephew Glenn Yates to the funeral, you know, did come good, and at least that boy got to his mother's funeral and, you know, was able to grieve with family. But I think we're getting to the bottom of the barrel, Tiger, when all of a sudden, you know, when we're going to save money, it's going to be saving it by stopping people from going to the funerals of their mothers and fathers. I just think there's, at some point, we've got to draw a line and say, no, mate, we got to get these folk there.
Well, there's been some cost-cutting and budget cuts over here in Queensland under the recent arrival of a bloke that just seems, I don't know how you would describe him, but he's certainly shouldn't be called the Premier of the state. certainly shouldn't be, mate. The Murray Court has been closed. Oh, now, not just the Murray Court, there have been serious cuts to in health, in areas where there needs to be where there needs to be funds and programs running and stuff like that, some serious cuts in health. But the Murray Court has impacted on incarceration and the rates of incarceration of our mob, and I think they've worked relatively well. And it's just sad to see Murray Courts go and stuff like that. Look, there's also another situation I want to talk about, and it's another service, a government service, and that is Victims of Crime Service. But before we do, I've got a caller on the line. Let's see who we have. Hello, who we got? Welcome to Let's Talk.
Yes, hello, Tiger. This is Paul speaking.
Paul, what would you like to say, Paul?
Oh, you mentioned something about before the treatment of our elderly people.
Yeah.
My auntie, my father's sister, was in a nursing home, and she actually died as a result of being scalded to death in the shower. The nurse put her in the shower and forgot about her and come back, and she was scalded to death. And then my father later on gained Alzheimer's, and he was put in a nursing home also, and he was in a very good nursing home for 2 or 3 years, and then he was on a waiting list to move into this one in Sunbury, Victoria, and he was there, and he passed away a week later from kidney failure, and the doctor had a look at him and discovered that he had only been fed a couple of meals, and the fluid that his body contained said he was lucky to have been given half a dozen drinks in that week. And my younger sister, as a result of it, went and done a nursing course, and her job full-time now is just going in and out of nursing homes, just sort of policing the treatment of elderly people, and she has the authority to fire or suspend people as she sees fit if they're neglected or...
That's a good example of your sister, a good example of taking things into your own hands, or trying to be a part of the solution instead of sitting back waiting for governments to change their systems and laws and legislation and stuff like that. It's sad that these deaths have been the reason that she's gone and done it. You know, deaths in the family is sad. Tell me, you're a First Nations man or a member of the dominant culture, dominant society?
I'm half Australian, half Native American.
All right, yeah. Okay. Now, it's certainly sad, but my comments were in relation to the anthem, you know. How do you feel when the anthem, you listen to the words and you analyse it and think about it and stuff, and how do you feel about that anthem? What are your thoughts about the anthem?
Well, I'm very proud of both cultures, but having said that, it's getting harder and harder to be patriotic when your own government is saying, you know, take it. You know, you got no options these days. They tell you how it is. They put it into legislation. We're just expected to wear it.
That's right, yeah. All right, buddy. Hey, thanks for your call.
No worries. Thank you.
You have a good day.
Okay, you too.
Bye now. And we do have another caller on the line. Hello. Welcome to Let's Talk.
Hey, this is Darren Axtell.
Darren Axtell, how are you? You're the man that lost your brother. You called me some months back while I was talking to Jerry Georgiatis, and mate, very sad to hear the passing of your brother. It's a hell of a way to go and a hell of a thing to experience. What would you like to say?
I guess the custodial system has failed us once again. My brother was in their care just on remand, and basically his human rights weren't met. His medication wasn't given to him 2 days after he went to HACA, as I said last time, which gave him the problem. And when he went to hospital, they sort of knew that it was a result of not giving medication, that he had some massive problems. So they sent him to Casuarina, which had an infirmary, but he sort of was in that ill condition that he needed to be stopping in hospital, but they kept on sort of trying to clear the bed, and because of the prisoner, just getting back to the actual infirmary where they weren't looking after him. He developed pneumonia from the blood leaking from his heart, from his mitral valves, and sort of got him up there and got him half stable again, ready for his heart cuffing procedure that he needed to actually sustain life. They sort of was ready to go at Charlie Gardner's hospital, but they sent him back to the infirmary just basically on new medication to stop his heart bleeding, which dried his kidneys out, and he actually ended up coming back in 5 or 6 days later after countless amounts of time asking for someone to give him help. My mother actually had to ring the superintendent of the jail and ask and beg for her son's life because he was in that much kidney pain. He hadn't eaten for 4 days. He was violently ill. When he got back up, he was in critical condition again and basically had to fight for his life because his basic human rights weren't met, and he had a real uphill battle from then to the day he died. He was in massive amounts of pain. And
what was his crime, Darren? Why was he inside?
Basically, he was inside on remand because he broke a DVO with his partner. He had a car accident. He ran off the side of the road. She picked him up from hospital and took him back to her place. The police saw the car on the side of the road, went around there. He actually broke that DVO by being in that property.
So he wasn't there bashing her?
No, they had a couple of run-ins. prior to it, but he was there and she was actually trying at that stage to get the DVO dropped.
And that's why he was incarcerated. That's why he was put in jail.
He was actually also going to be questioned about a stolen car and some phone taps as well on his phone. He did have charges to answer to, but he actually hadn't been to court, hadn't been convicted of anything at all. When he was let out the day of on bail, I actually picked him up trying to get his car back off the side of the highway, which he hadn't actually done anything else. And it was almost like they set him up. They got two or three of them together and locked him up. And
so he hadn't been convicted of anything?
Not at all.
On this occasion, he wasn't convicted of anything. He was sitting in there waiting to answer, waiting to be questioned, waiting to answer against charges and things, but hadn't been convicted. And yes, you've had to bury him.
Tomorrow is the day. Going to be the most horrific day of my life. Yeah.
What happens tomorrow?
But tomorrow we're putting him in the ground. Yeah, bringing him back over here to where he wanted to go for repatriation. So
How old was he?
38 years old.
How old, sorry?
38.
My God, a young man.
Too young.
A young man. You must be angry. What would you like people to do that are listening? I mean, you don't treat... Oh, this is just outrageous, mate. But what would you like to see happen?
The whole correctional system needs to be overhauled. They actually, in the remand centre, they actually didn't have any medical care for a person of his health at all. He actually required medication to keep him alive, and he wasn't given that. He was given Panadol when he asked for his medication. He didn't have a cold. He actually had a life-threatening illness, and he was waiting for his heart clipping procedure. Once that would give him a bit more time, he was going to be going onto an organ donor list once he actually ticked all the boxes.
That would have bought some time, yeah.
Oh, that would have bought the rest of his life. Now he's leaving behind three children.
Yeah. You must have some anger.
I've got a lot of anger. Beside his bed for 45 days, seeing him black and blue, just from the bed bruising, the pain he was going through with his kidneys drying out right before my eyes.
Was he shackled?
He was shackled for the first three visits, and the last visit he was shackled for a week and a half. The day I flew to Perth on the second occasion, we actually had to lobby and petition to the correction system to get them removed, and that's with the backing of all the coronary care doctors. He was actually breathing very shallow. He was no threat to anyone. I don't know. There was prison rooms beside him that actually weren't getting through to the same. He was pretty heavily illustrated. Not too sure if they thought he was a threat. He was a threat to no one at all. Yeah. The Serco guards on him 24 hours a day. But sort of he battled right to the end. They sort of kept on telling us.
So is there a call or an expectation that from yourself, your family, that they might, I don't know, have proper, if they're not going to provide the proper facilities inside correctional centres, they should be transported directly to hospital, should they not? One would think.
They should. And every time they got him half stable so that he actually sort of like he was sort of okay and getting towards the procedure, he'd be gone. Back to the infirmary.
They transfer him back to the centre.
They weren't keen to pay the cost of two guards on him all day long. The coronary care unit in Royal Perth Hospital's beds were just, everything was totally full. As soon as one person would leave, someone would come through. So the hospital system has got to take some responsibility for this as well. Every time that I got him stable and he didn't need to be on a life support machine, that was good enough for them to transport him back to Casuarina. It just like a sacrificial lamb going to slaughter.
Well, they could have cut their cost in half, but if they needed a guard there, and you're saying he wasn't in any condition to be doing anything but struggling to breathe, they could have cut their cost in half and have one guard there.
Yeah, I think it's just all protocol and regulation. They need two guys there. They've got their bag full of weapons in case. But, yeah, 24 hours a day.
It's just outrageous. Mate, once again, we're very sorry to hear of this and for you and your family to have to experience this and those children to be left behind and stuff. Mate, it's a sick system. And, again, condolences go out to you. And thanks for your call, eh?
Okay, thanks, Tiger.
Right,
thanks, Jerry.
Thanks, mate. Jerry? Jerry?
I just had to hear all that. Yeah, I'm here.
Doesn't look good. Where is our Jerry? Oh, we've got you. You there?
I'm here.
Jerry?
Yeah, I'm here. It was just sad listening to all that. It just shows what's indicative with the system, and I think you said it well. It's a sick system.
Sorry, mate, I've got something
that needs to be fixed.
I've got something that's not working for me here with... you there. That should picture up. Say that again, please.
I was just saying, it was sad listening to Darren just there. I think you've said it correctly, Tiger. It's a sick system. It's an ailing system. It's a system that needs overhauled, needs to be fixed, and there'll be more broken lives. There'll be more loss of life if the system is allowed to continue on in this way. You know, there's, like I said in the beginning, there's a litany of these sad stories, and the third world conditions people are being treated in our prisons.
Well, you know, it used to be, us blacks used to think, First Nations people used to think it was just us, but, you know, but we're seeing that it's spread wider, it's much worse. And the real concern for me, Jerry, is we can look back in time, and it can be just in yours and my lifetime, it can be back to our parents' lifetimes and beyond. But we can look back at treatment of people, we can look back at the society, how it was and how it is. And we can look forward, and the sad part of it is I don't think we can look forward with any anticipation of change or improvement or humanity or recognition of human rights. How do you feel?
Sadly, Tiger, I think you're correct. We've got to keep on fighting the good fight, and we've got to keep on advocating, and we've got to keep on saying it as it is, and we've got to keep on highlighting it out there, and we've got to make it the light of day. But I get dejected because I see the people that I talk to hide behind liability. I see them hide behind efficacy cuts. I see them hide behind a lack of will, not just political will, but just the will in general to do the right thing. And I, on another day on your program, I'll describe, you know, another dozen predicaments just as bad as, sadly, Anthony Axtell and many others or whatever that we've discussed
in the
past.
But all right, mate.
Little is changing.
It certainly is. Listen, thanks for your time today, and keep up the good fight, as you say. You have a good day, man.
Thanks, Tiger, and thanks to all listeners across the nation, and my best to Anthony's family.
Safe travels. Thank you. Bye, Jerry. Jerry Georgiadis joining us today. And such a sad state of affairs is this system, this society, the structures. And people can do something about it. We can start to mobilise. We can begin to ask questions or make demands. We can.